Escuelas oficiales de idiomas. Pruebas de certificación. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Certificado de nivel avanzado. Tarea 1. Dispone de un minuto para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 1, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 1. Primera audición.
Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, was the mother of the present Queen of England and always held a special place in the hearts of the British people. She was born the Honourable Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Lyons in the summer of 1900. The ninth child in what would become a family of 10, she was a vivacious tomboy and became known affectionately as the Imp. Educated at home by her mother and governess, Elizabeth was fluent in French by the age of 10. As Elizabeth grew up, her charm and personality made her very popular. She was introduced to Prince Albert at a dance in 1920, and it's said he fell in love at first sight. At Westminster Abbey in April 1923, Bertie, the Duke of York and the second son of King George V, married Elizabeth Bowes Lyons. The Duke and Duchess led an ordered and settled life with their two small daughters, the Princesses Elizabeth and Margaret. But their quiet life was soon to change forever. In January 1936, King George V died, and he was succeeded by the Prince of Wales. 11 months later, he abdicated the crown to marry a divorced American, Wallace Simpson. As next in line to the crown, Albert, known as King George VI, was crowned, but he was unprepared to rule, but with Elizabeth's devoted support, he became one of the country's best-loved monarchs. The Second World War brought the king his most severe test. Despite strong advice that Queen Elizabeth and the princesses should leave London for Canada, the Queen refused to go. Even after Buckingham Palace was bombed, she stayed in the capital throughout the war. Both she and her husband travelled all over Britain, visiting bomb-ravaged cities, bringing hope and comfort to their people. The King and Queen celebrated their silver wedding anniversary, and King George spoke to the nation of the inspiration he received from 25 years of marriage. But just 4 years later, in 1952, the king died at the age of just 56. Never was the passing of a monarch marked with such deep sorrow. Without a son, his elder daughter Elizabeth succeeded him, returning from a state visit to Africa with her husband, Prince Philip. For the young Queen Elizabeth II, the support of her mother was invaluable. The generational change from Queen to Queen Mother did not mean that she could sit back and relax in retirement. Quite the opposite, in fact. The Queen Mother had no intention of giving up her public duties, and as the years rolled by, she continued to serve with engagements at home and overseas. She kept up a schedule of work that would have taxed someone half her age. At the age of 97, the Queen Mother underwent a second hip replacement operation, and days later managed to walk out of the hospital unaided to the cheers of a waiting crowd. As the world moved into a new millennium, the Queen Mother celebrated her 100th birthday, and more than 7,000 people from the Queen Mother's charities participated. It was this genuine love of people that kept her in the country's heart. She was as comfortable with the man on the street as with her family and friends. It was her gracious manner and ready smile which endeared her to people. Many will remember her as the woman who established a global benchmark for kings and queens during changing times. Many will remember her as the smiling woman who brought charm, sincerity, and dignity to the British throne. At her passing, at the age of 103, her nation wept and the whole world mourned.
Tarea 1. Segunda audición.
Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother, was the mother of the present Queen of England and always held a special place in the hearts of the British people. She was born the Honourable Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Lyons in the summer of 1900, the ninth child in what would become a family of 10. She was a vivacious tomboy and became known affectionately as the Imp. Educated at home by her mother and governess, Elizabeth was fluent in French by the age of 10. As Elizabeth grew up, her charm and personality made her very popular. She was introduced to Prince Albert at a dance in 1920, and it said he fell in love at first sight. At Westminster Abbey in April 1923, Bertie, the Duke of York, and the second son of King George V, married Elizabeth Bowes Lyons. The Duke and Duchess led an ordered and settled life with their two small daughters, the Princesses Elizabeth and Margaret. But their quiet life was soon to change forever. In January 1936, King George V died, and he was succeeded by the Prince of Wales. But 11 months later, he abdicated the crown to marry a divorced American, Wallace Simpson. As next in line to the crown, Albert, known as King George VI, was crowned, but he was unprepared to rule, but with Elizabeth's devoted support, he became one of the country's best-loved monarchs. The Second World War brought the king his most severe test. Despite strong advice that Queen Elizabeth and the princesses should leave London for Canada, the Queen refused to go. Even after Buckingham Palace was bombed, she stayed in the capital throughout the war. Both she and her husband travelled all over Britain, visiting bomb-ravaged cities, bringing hope and comfort to their people. The King and Queen celebrated their silver wedding anniversary, and King George spoke to the nation of the inspiration he received from 25 years of marriage. But just 4 years later, in 1952, the king died at the age of just 56. Never was the passing of a monarch marked with such deep sorrow. Without a son, his elder daughter Elizabeth succeeded him, returning from a state visit to Africa with her husband, Prince Philip. For the young Queen Elizabeth II, the support of her mother was invaluable. The generational change from Queen to Queen Mother did not mean that she could sit back and relax in retirement. Quite the opposite, in fact. The Queen Mother had no intention of giving up her public duties, and as the years rolled by, she continued to serve with engagements at home and overseas. She kept up a schedule of work that would have taxed someone half her age. At the age of 97, the Queen Mother underwent a second hip replacement operation, and days later managed to walk out of the hospital unaided to the cheers of a waiting crowd. As the world moved into a new millennium, the Queen Mother celebrated her 100th birthday, and more than 7,000 people from the Queen Mother's charities participated. It was this genuine love of people that kept her in the country's heart. She was as comfortable with the man on the street as with her family and friends. It was her gracious manner and ready smile which endeared her to people. Many will remember her as the woman who established a global benchmark for kings and queens during changing times. Many will remember her as the smiling woman who brought charm, sincerity, and dignity to the British throne. At her passing, at the age of 103, her nation wept and the whole world mourned.
Tarea 2. Dispone de un minuto para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 2, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 2. Primera audición.
Well, let's hear from someone who is up for it. Tom Ilube from London has already bought his ticket.
I bought my ticket from X-Corp and it cost $100,000, which is about £60,000, but I think it's going up to $150,000 in January.
Tom, tell me what you get for your money.
So you sit in the Lynx spacecraft, which looks a bit like a fighter jet with a pilot alongside you and you're effectively in the co-pilot seat. The craft takes off horizontally like a normal plane off the runway, but then very quickly it turns straight up vertically and then blasts upwards 100 kilometres. A typical passenger flight would be at about 10 kilometres. So this is going up to 100 kilometres until it bursts out into space and then you're weightless and it drifts around for a little while and then gradually it comes back in. And then when it comes back in, it sort of circles down and you have pretty big G-forces on you pushing you back until it gets back down and hopefully lands in the same place that it started from.
Tell me a bit about yourself, Tom. What is it about you that makes you want to do this?
I'm a technology entrepreneur and I have a big passion for science. I studied physics and I'm also very involved in education. So I'm starting a girls' science academy in Ghana next year. And I want to be able to stand in front of young people like that and say, look, a normal person like me has gone from where I started and up into space. Imagine what you can do. And also, it just strikes me as outrageous that in our lifetime someone can actually go into space. I mean, it's almost, how could you not do that if you get the chance?
Some people would think, how could you do it? I mean, you're not scared.
Yes, I'm terrified. When I told my wife, she said, well, you don't like flights and you don't like roller coaster rides, so why on earth are you doing it? But my brother Jim died a few years ago, and he was my inspiration, and he just loved life. So he would be saying, well, hold on, you can afford it and you want to do it, so why on earth aren't you doing it?
So you're listening to the voice of the spirit of your brother, but not your wife?
Pretty much.
We've been hearing, haven't we all, for years that this would be possible, space tourism, but the dates keep getting pushed back. At Virgin, they had a terrible setback with it, didn't they? And someone was killed. Realistically, when do you think you're going to get this flight?
I think it'll probably be next 3 to 5 years, but it really doesn't matter hugely. I mean, I think if it's something that you've decided you want to do, then it almost makes no difference. I mean, we're talking about potentially going into space. It doesn't matter whether it's delayed a year, 2 years, 3 years. It makes absolutely no difference to me.
How long would you wait before you ask for a refund?
Until I was too old, I think.
How old is too old?
I think I'd have to be in my 60s before I sort of thought, actually, am I sure I want to do this?
How old are you now?
I'm 52.
What would your wife have done with the £60,000?
I have no idea. But,
oh, you must go home and ask her.
She wouldn't have gone into space, that's for sure.
Tarea 2. Segunda audición.
Well, let's hear from someone who is up for it. Tom Ilube from London has already bought his ticket.
I bought my ticket from X-Corp and it cost $100,000, which is about £60,000, but I think it's going up to $150,000 in January.
Tom, tell me what you get for your money.
So you sit in the Lynx spacecraft, which looks a bit like a fighter jet with a pilot alongside you and you're effectively in the co-pilot seat. The craft takes off horizontally like a normal plane off the runway, but then very quickly it turns straight up vertically and then blasts upwards 100 kilometres. A typical passenger flight would be at about 10 kilometres. So this is going up to 100 kilometres until it bursts out into space and then you're weightless and it drifts around for a little while and then gradually it comes back in. And then when it comes back in, it sort of circles down and you have pretty big G-forces on you pushing you back until it gets back down and hopefully lands in the same place that it started from.
Tell me a bit about yourself, Tom. What is it about you that makes you want to do this?
I'm a technology entrepreneur and I have a big passion for science. I studied physics and I'm also very involved in education. So I'm starting a girls' science academy in Ghana next year. And I want to be able to stand in front of young people like that and say, look, a normal person like me has gone from where I started and up into space. Imagine what you can do. And also, it just strikes me as outrageous that in our lifetime someone can actually go into space. I mean, it's almost, how could you not do that if you get the chance?
Some people would think, how could you do it? I mean, you're not scared.
Yes, I'm terrified. When I told my wife, she said, well, you don't like flights and you don't like roller coaster rides, so why on earth are you doing it? But my brother Jim died a few years ago, and he was my inspiration, and he just loved life. So he would be saying, well, hold on, you can afford it and you want to do it, so why on earth aren't you doing it?
So you're listening to the voice of the spirit of your brother, but not your wife.
Pretty much.
We've been hearing, haven't we all, for years that this would be possible, space tourism, but the dates keep getting pushed back. At Virgin, they had a terrible setback with it, didn't they? And someone was killed. Realistically, when do you think you're going to get this flight?
I think it'll probably be next 3 to 5 years, but it really doesn't matter hugely. I mean, I think if it's something that you've decided you want to do, then it almost makes no difference. I mean, we're talking about potentially going into space. It doesn't matter whether it's delayed a year, 2 years, 3 years. It makes absolutely no difference to me.
How long would you wait before you ask for a refund?
Until I was too old, I think.
How old is too old?
I think I'd have to be in my 60s before I sort of thought, actually, am I sure I want to do this?
How old are you now?
I'm 52.
What would your wife have done with the £60,000?
I have no idea, but...
Oh, you must go home and ask her.
She wouldn't have gone into space, that's for sure.
Tarea 3. Dispone de un minuto para leer los ejercicios correspondientes a esta tarea. A continuación de la lectura, escuchará dos veces el texto o los textos orales correspondientes a la tarea 3, con un intervalo de 20 segundos. Tarea 3. Primera audición.
Text 0.
There's still a sizable portion of the population that just doesn't believe that the climate is changing.
That's David Salveson, a research associate at the University of North Carolina's Institute for the Environment. By producing documentary videos that feature real people in real places, he hopes to help convince skeptical North Carolinians that global warming is real.
What if they heard stories from people who were like them? So farmers and fishermen and Christmas tree growers and oyster growers and hunters. These are people who spend a lot of time outside. They're very observant. They've seen changes happen. And so my interest was in capturing their stories about what they've seen or heard and how it affects them.
A lifelong fisherman describing how streams are getting warmer and there are fewer trout resonates with people in a way that scientists describing climate data does not. Salveson hopes to continue recording these first-person stories and eventually add interviews with scientists to explain the changes and provide more context. For now, his work focuses on North Carolina.
Text 1. It is the longest migration of any insect, a 2-month journey of 3,000 miles. So scientists want to understand how a humble butterfly achieves this impressive feat of navigation. To investigate, the University of Washington scientists and their colleagues studied individual tethered butterflies, recording from their antennae and eyes as they flew. This revealed that the insects have an internal compass, able to keep them on course using only the position of the sun. The team has now built a model circuit that works in just the same way as the solar compass in every butterfly's brain. A navigating system that uses the sun to work out the direction of travel, then make adjustments to stay on a southerly track to Mexico. The researchers eventually plan to build robotic insects that are both powered by and able to navigate using only the sun. One possible mission for a robotic butterfly would be to track the monarchs as they migrate, helping scientists to work out why this unique species is in decline. Text 2.
The long-lasting and severe drought in California led Governor Jerry Brown to order new and historic water restrictions today. The mandatory rules are designed to reduce water use by 25% through 2016. The governor made the announcement on a day when winter snowpack is measured in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Today, there was no snow on the ground, and the snowpack is lower than at any time since 1950. Hari Srinivasan is in California, and he joins us now from our public broadcasting station, KPBS, in San Diego.
In fact, Governor Brown went to the Sierra Nevada mountains today to make his point. The restrictions would affect water use in a number of ways, including landscaping and lawns, farming, golf courses, and more. The governor joins us now from Sacramento. Thanks for being with us. First, even going back to your state of the state address in 2014, you've been talking about this state of emergency. There's been plenty of scientific data to back up this drought. So what took so long to get these restrictions in place?
Well, what takes so long is we're a large state.
Text 3.
California has got one heck of a problem, and Californians are only beginning to wake up to that reality now. How should they be thinking?
Good morning. Well, they're waking up slowly, and that's part of the mistake. How should they be thinking? There are two things. We're in year four of the drought just in California. This drought might last two more years or six more years. It could last a decade. You could literally have sixth and seventh graders with no memory of real rainstorms. So part one is you need to figure out how to make it through the next few years, the short term, how to keep business growing and thriving. California's economy has come back. How to keep the farms working. Half the produce in the United States comes from California. But I think much more important, California needs to reinvent its water system, which is incredibly elaborate and complex, to account for this kind of dryness. The system that exists doesn't work very well, and they need a long...
Text 4.
And now an environmental story with good news. After years of decline, monarch butterflies appear to be on the rebound. These butterflies migrate some 2,500 miles from Canada to forests in Mexico every year. It's an arduous journey, and they've been hit hard by the use of herbicides and habitat loss along the way. But this year, the World Wildlife Fund reports that the monarch butterflies that are wintering in Mexico are covering a much greater area than last year. Jorge Ricards is Field Programs Director with WWF Mexico, and he joins us via Skype from Mexico City. Hello.
Hello.
So this is the second year that the numbers are up. What kind of numbers are we talking about?
We are reporting 4 hectares of overwintering colonies. That's 9.1 acres. That is the area that they occupy. So that is indeed a very good news compared to last year, where we only had a little bit over 1 hectare.
You've been out in the field with them. Just describe for our listeners what, if they haven't been able to see them, what these monarch butterflies look like when they come to stay in Mexico.
Text 5.
The drought in California has been going on for 5 years now. But if you've turned on the TV recently, or for that matter, if you live in California, you may have noticed it's raining there a lot. The storms this past week are fueled by an El Niño, which is essentially a temperature change in the Pacific that has brought unseasonably warm temperatures to much of the country and a whole lot of precipitation, especially in southern and central California. The question is, what difference does any of this rain make to California's historic drought? Alice Walton is a reporter with the LA Times, and she's been writing about all this. She joins us from our studios at NPR West. Hi, Alice. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Time for some very basic questions. Where is this rain going? And is all of this precipitation enough to make a dent in the empty reservoirs and aquifers?
Well, it will make a dent, but it certainly won't end the drought. As you said, we've had a drought for about 5 years now, which means we're really at a deficit. Weather forecasters say you'd have to have many times the average amount of rain to make up all that difference, and that's just not realistic.
Tarea 3. Segunda audición.
Text zero.
There's still a sizable portion of the population that just doesn't believe that the climate is changing.
That's David Salveson, a research associate at the University of North Carolina's Institute for the Environment. By producing documentary videos that feature real people in real places, he hopes to help convince skeptical North Carolinians that global warming is real.
What if they heard stories from people who were like them? So farmers and fishermen and Christmas tree growers and oyster growers and hunters. These are people who spend a lot of time outside. They're very observant. They've seen changes happen. And so my interest was in capturing their stories about what they've seen or heard and how it affects them.
A lifelong fisherman describing how streams are getting warmer and there are fewer trout resonates with people in a way that scientists describing climate data does not. Salveson hopes to continue recording these first-person stories and eventually add interviews with scientists to explain the changes and provide more context. For now, his work focuses on North Carolina.
Text 1.
It is the longest migration of any insect, a two-month journey of 3,000 miles. So scientists want to understand how a humble butterfly achieves this impressive feat of navigation. To investigate, the University of Washington scientists and their colleagues studied individual tethered butterflies, recording from their antennae and eyes as they flew. This revealed that the insects have an internal compass, able to keep them on course using only the position of the sun. The team has now built a model circuit that works in just the same way as the solar compass in every butterfly's brain, a navigating system that uses the sun to work out the direction of travel, then make adjustments to stay on a southerly track to Mexico. The researchers eventually plan to build robotic insects that are both powered by and able to navigate using only the sun. One possible mission for a robotic butterfly would be to track the monarchs as they migrate, helping scientists to work out why this unique species is in decline.
Text 2.
The long-lasting and severe drought in California led Governor Jerry Brown to order new and historic water restrictions today. The mandatory rules are designed to reduce water use by 25% through 2016. The governor made the announcement on a day when winter snowpack is measured in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Today, there was no snow on the ground, and the snowpack is lower than at any time since 1950. Hari Srinivasan is in California, and he joins us now from our public broadcasting station, KPBS, in San Diego.
In fact, Governor Brown went to the Sierra Nevada mountains today to make his point. The restrictions would affect water use in a number of ways, including landscaping and lawns, farming, golf courses, and more. The governor joins us now from Sacramento. Thanks for being with us. First, even going back to your state of the state address in 2014, you've been talking about this state of emergency. There's been plenty of scientific data to back up this drought. So what took so long to get these restrictions in place?
Well, what takes so long is we're a large state.
Text 3.
California has got one heck of a problem, and Californians are only beginning to wake up to that reality now. How should they be thinking?
Good morning. Well, they're waking up slowly, and that's part of the mistake. How should they be thinking? There are two things. We're in year four of the drought just in California. This drought might last two more years or six more years. It could last a decade. You could literally have sixth and seventh graders with no memory of real rainstorms. So part one is you need to figure out how to make it through the next few years, the short term, how to keep business growing and thriving. California's economy has come back. How to keep the farms working. Half the produce in the United States comes from California. But I think much more important, California needs to reinvent its water system, which is incredibly elaborate and complex, to account for this kind of dryness. The system that exists doesn't work very well, and they need a long...
Text 4.
And now an environmental story with good news. After years of decline, monarch butterflies appear to be on the rebound. These butterflies migrate some 2,500 miles from Canada to forests in Mexico every year. It's an arduous journey, and they've been hit hard by the use of herbicides and habitat loss along the way. But this year, the World Wildlife Fund reports that the monarch butterflies that are wintering in Mexico are covering a much greater area than last year. Jorge Ricards is Field Programs Director with WWF Mexico, and he joins us via Skype from Mexico City. Hello.
Hello.
So this is the second year that the numbers are up. What kind of numbers are we talking about?
We are reporting 4 hectares of overwintering colonies. That's 9.1 acres. That is the area that they occupy. So that is indeed a very good news compared to last year, where we only had a little bit over 1 hectare.
You've been out in the field with them. Just describe for our listeners what, if they haven't been able to see them, what these monarch butterflies look like when they come to stay in Mexico.
Text 5.
The drought in California has been going on for 5 years now. But if you've turned on the TV recently, or for that matter, if you live in California, you may have noticed it's raining there a lot. The storms this past week are fueled by an El Niño, which is essentially a temperature change in the Pacific that has brought unseasonably warm temperatures to much of the country and a whole lot of precipitation, especially in southern and central California. The question is, what difference does any of this rain make to California's historic drought? Alice Walton is a reporter with the LA Times, and she's been writing about all this. She joins us from our studios at NPR West. Hi, Alice. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Time for some very basic questions. Where is this rain going? And is all of this precipitation enough to make a dent in the empty reservoirs and aquifers?
Well, it will make a dent, but it certainly won't end the drought. As you said, we've had a drought for about 5 years now, which means we're really at a deficit. Weather forecasters say you'd have to have many times the average amount of rain to make up all that difference, and that's just not realistic.
La prueba de comprensión oral ha finalizado. Deje su cuadernillo de examen cerrado sobre la mesa, compruebe que ha consignado en su portada los datos requeridos y siga las instrucciones del examinador.